podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 36. Avoiding death, not taxes. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audible.com/biotech today for details. And by GoToMeeting. For a free month of online meetings, visit gotomeeting.com/biotech.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapist?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome back to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. This week, we're extremely fortunate because we have Dr. Cynthia Kenyon here to talk about her work on the genetics of aging. We've had a couple of shows on the topic, one with Dr. Leonard Grante, who's a Novartis professor of biology at MIT, and also Aubrey de Grey, who's a theoretical biologist. But I wanted to get us back into the lab because it's the lab work that truly defines the state of the science. Now, if you look back at history, life expectancy has gone from about 30 years in classical Greece to somewhere between 78 and 82 in some countries today. But if you look at the results coming out of the labs, we know that we're not living up to our true genetic potential. And when Dr. Kenyon's research gets translated to clinic, it will be a true game changer for humanity. There's no doubt about it. So, without further ado, on to our interview.
So I'd like to know a little bit about how you got started in studying the biology of aging, and also maybe how you got into the worm. I don't know which came first, but you're working on an interesting model. So.
Well, we've been studying the little worm C. elegans for a long time, but I became more and more interested as time went on in studying the process of aging, because aging is something that people had just generally thought happened in a kind of random and haphazard way. You just get old like an old car. And they didn't think there was really anything to study. But I had been studying other processes in biology, not aging, but other things, like how a fertilized egg develops into an animal, for example. And the kinds of things we were finding was that processes that you might think would happen in a kind of random, haphazard way tended actually not to. They tended to be subject to some kind of control by the genes. And the other thing that people, our lab and many other labs were finding, was that things that happened in a certain way in one animal, one species, tended to happen in the same way in another species, even if it looks very different. So, for example, the way a cell is told to divide into two cells in a little worm is really the same way that our cells are told to divide into two cells. It's no different, even though the worms look very different. And if you look around in nature, all animals pretty much seem to age, but they do so at different rates. That's what's really interesting. So, for example, our little worms, C. elegans, they're microscopic. They're about the size of a comma in a sentence. And they age really quickly. They're dead. They get old and they die in about a month or less, actually, maybe 2 or 3 weeks on average. But a mouse lives for 2 years, a canary lives for 15 to 20 years, and a bat can live to be 50. So you see a huge difference in the rate of aging in different animals. And so you have to ask, well, why is that? It's not environment, because you know, a bat, a canary, and a mouse will all have their different lifespans if they're living in the same place. So it's the genes. The genes are making them age at different rates. So that says right off the bat that there have to be genes that have a really big effect on aging. And it also says that you have to be able to change lifespan by changing these genes. Because remember, all these animals evolved from a common precursor during evolution. So you probably had some primitive little animal with a simple animal with a short lifespan, presumably eons ago. And the way we all got our longer lifespans was from changing genes by mutations. So that suggested a whole different way of looking at aging, that aging could be, or the rate of aging would be controlled to a large extent by the genes. And it would also be plastic. In other words, it would be not so difficult to change the rate of aging. So, for example, there are short-lived and long-lived mammals, there are short-lived and long-lived birds, and there are short-lived and long-lived insects. So that means the ability to live long had to have evolved more than once, right? From the first bird and the first insect and the first vertebrate, first mammal, you see what I'm saying? So it really suggests that there's a lot of plasticity there.
Are there two related organisms that are very closely related genetically that have drastic aging differences?
Well, there is. Here's a good example. The honeybee. Bees can, you know, with the same genes, you can have the queen, which lives many, many years, or a worker, which has a much, much shorter lifespan, less than a year. So, and these animals actually have the same DNA. So that's sort of going against what I said, because they have the same genes, but they're presumably using the genes differently to have these different lifespans. People don't really know what it is about the expression of these different genes that's affecting the rate of aging in the honeybee. But that'll be an interesting thing to find in the future. So the idea then, so I had this idea that aging was going to be something that was going to be subject to some kind of control, some real control by the genes. And there were evolutionary arguments to suggest that that could never happen because you don't start to age until after you've reproduced. So there wouldn't be a lot of selection on the aging process. But I thought that nevertheless, something as fundamental as aging might really be controlled in a more active way by the genes. There might be some beautiful regulatory circuitry that controlled aging. So we decided, if that's the case, we could take our little worms, which have a short lifespan, and we could look for mutants that would cause the worms to live longer. Or shorter, but the shorter ones, they could just be sick. But if you get a mutant that lives long, in other words, a mutant is an animal where it's just like a normal animal, except you've changed one gene, and that's a mutant. And so we wanted to find mutants that live long. And we were optimistic because there had already been the discovery in several other labs of a mutation in the worm, a change in a gene that increased lifespan, at least to some extent, about 50%. But not much was known about the mutant, but at least it was there. So that was pretty interesting. So we set out to look for long-lived mutants. And we found mutations that affected one particular gene that had the name DAF2 that actually doubled the lifespan of the animal, which was really amazing. No one thought that was possible. It was the whole fact that it was possible to take a multicellular animal, you know, with a nervous system and muscles and intestine, everything that we have. Well, not, I mean, can't do arithmetic, but I mean, they're real little animals. And you could change one gene and dramatically slow down the rate of aging, keep the animals, you know, dancing around while the normal worms are in the nursing home, really.
Well, and then I can do arithmetic. So if we have a conserved DAF2, couldn't you, or another gene, very closely related, could we perhaps extend through one single gene the human lifespan to 200 years?
Well, that's a really good question. Another way to put that question is the following. If we could do it, then why aren't those people out there? I mean, why aren't there sort of mutant people that live to be 200? So that's a really good question. It's not clear. It's not clear why. Maybe it's not so easy in humans. Or maybe it could happen, but it hasn't happened. Or it happened, but the person was run over by a car. I don't know, you know. But you don't see a lot of those people in nature. What you do see, though, you see people who live to be 100, and the ability to live to be 100 runs in families. So that does tell you that there are forms of genes, of human genes. You know, we have 20,000 genes in our bodies, 20 to 30, whatever, 20,000. And I'm sorry, we don't have 20,000. We have about 35,000 genes. Sorry about that. Worms have 20,000. We have about 35,000 genes. But you can, the genes, you know, that I have and that my next door neighbor had, even though they're the same gene, they might not be identical to one another. They could differ slightly from one another. And so the idea then would be that some slight difference in one particular gene might be responsible for a person's ability or a family's ability to, you know, produce or contain many people who live to be 100. And it turns out, actually, that the same genes that we first discovered in the worm that I'm going to tell you about, there are forms of these genes that do seem to allow people to live to be very old.
Wow.
So they do seem to be having an effect. Not 200, but so, at least 100.
So this worm is relevant. A relevant absolutely. Model with respect to human
yeah,
aging.
That's what's been so absolutely fantastic about what we've discovered. So basically the first question is, what does the gene that we change do? How did we affect the lifespan of the animal?
Let me ask one question before that, because this is for general audience. What exactly is the roundworm? So that people know,
okay.
You did say it was a small worm about the size of a comma, but where is this found in nature, and how do you work with it, and then how do you change a gene, and then maybe if you could explain how DAF2 and works.
Okay, so basically they're very small, like I said, about the size of a comma. You need a microscope to see them, and they live in the soil. They're harmless. They're also called nematodes. Their scientific name is Caenorhabditis elegans, or C. elegans for short. And elegans sounds like the word elegant, and I think it's because they're so beautiful. They look like horses' tails. They're very pretty. They move in a sort of sinusoidal way across the plates. We grow them on little plates with agar, which is like jello, in them with a little lawn of bacteria on top, and the worms eat the bacteria.
Are these bacteria to catch?
What?
Are they easy to catch? Do you spend half your day chasing
them? You can just, if you go outside and you dig up a teaspoon of soil, especially from a compost heap or something, and you bring it in and you put it under the microscope, you'll probably find some C. elegans.
Wow. No, I mean, I also meant in the lab when you're working with them, sometimes fruit flies can tend to escape your, get away, you know. Everybody knows when there's a fruit fly lab around because they see.
No, they're pretty easy to keep. They're not difficult. They're cheap to work on, and they're easy to keep, and they grow rapidly. They have a 3-day generation time. They only have about 1,000 cells in their whole body. But we know what all the cells are, and they all develop exactly the same way in every animal. So it's a fantastic little animal to work on. And actually, other people before we came along had investigated other biological processes in C. elegans. And they had discovered genes that do things like control cell division or the ability of cells to live or die at certain times. This is different from the animal's death. This is the death of individual cells in the animal. It's a process called apoptosis. Anyway, so basically these genes were first discovered in worms and then shown to be present in all animals doing the same things, including humans. So we were quite optimistic and hopeful too, that the genes we found that controlled aging would also control aging in animals besides worms. And they do. That's what's so cool. So basically, if you make the same gene change that we made in our worms in a fruit fly or a mouse or potentially a human, like I said, there are forms of this gene in humans that are associated with the ability to live to be 100. It's not so clear in humans because it's more difficult to study. But anyway, at least going from worms to flies to mice, you get a lifespan extension. And here's the other thing that's really cool. If we know that in order, so this is interesting. So we change this gene in the worms and the worms live longer. So that tells you, so the question is, what is the normal function of the gene? And it turns out the normal function of the gene is actually to speed up aging and slow and shorten lifespan. It's like the animal is working against itself. It's like the Grim Reaper inside of it. Because when we change the gene, we're making it not work so well.
How do you select that again? If it's a gene,
you don't
gene
actually.
That
what
death?
You do is you just change genes at random. You just change them randomly.
No, but how did this gene evolve? How did the organism adapt or come to have this gene?
It has other important functions in the animal. So I'll tell you about that. But let me finish my thought here that I was just telling you about the evolutionary conservation, and then we can talk about what the gene's actually doing. So that gene is called DAF2. When you remove the gene, then, or you damage it, worms live long, mice live long, fruit flies live long, and possibly people. When you, there's another gene, though, that's needed for that lifespan extension, and that's a gene called DAF16. Think of it as sweet 16 because it keeps the animal young. When you change the DAF2 gene in a way that makes the little worms live longer, what you do is you make the gene DAF16 more active. And that turns out also to be conserved. And in this case, it's even a stronger case. The conservation is even stronger in humans. The mice, again, fruit flies live long. The long-lived mice that you produce by changing the first gene I told you about in that DAF16 for mice is more active. And now there are that changes in that gene have been associated with the ability to live to reach exceptional ages in humans too. So it's very, very exciting. It really looks like these discoveries in C. elegans really apply to humans.
It's actually pretty remarkable. I mean, we're talking
it's amazing.
Not only paradigm-shifting understanding of biology, but sort of the age-old quest of, fountain of youth here.
Absolutely. It's mind-boggling. Yeah.
So with
it's really amazing.
Modulating the function of one gene leads to the activation of a second gene. So DAF2 leads to an upregulation of DAF16.
That's right, exactly.
And then
I'll start to tell you what they do, and you'll see how it really works.
Sure.
You can see how I'll tell you how it really works. But now that doesn't mean so these genes, DAF2 and DAF16, no gene works in isolation. They all work they encode proteins that have jobs to do in the cell. And proteins interact with other proteins and talk to other proteins. And so that's what DAF16 and DAF2 are doing as well. In humans and in worms. So the interactions that these gene products have with others is really important. So shall I tell you how it actually works at the molecular level?
Sure, go ahead.
Would you like me to do that? Okay.
Let's see if I get it.
So what is DAF2? Well, the DAF2 gene encodes a protein that functions as a receptor for hormones. So you know what hormones are? They're small substances that circulate in the body. And they cause the tissues to behave in some different way. So, for example, the hormone testosterone causes the fertilized egg with an XY chromosome complement to become a boy, and then it causes that boy to grow a beard and so forth. So, in other words, when it becomes a man. So, basically, hormones cause the tissues to behave in ways that they otherwise would not behave in. So, the DAF2 gene, and the way the tissues respond to the hormones is through hormone receptors, which are just what it sounds like. They're proteins that sit on the surface of the tissues that grab the hormone and send signals inside the tissues, initiating a cascade of events that leads to, for example, the growth of a beard in the case of testosterone. In our case, obviously, the hormone is signaling the receptor to tell the cell to get old faster. Okay. Kind of counterintuitive. So we have these hormone receptors. So what are they? Well, my answer may surprise you because you may not think that it may not seem to make any sense at the beginning. But the receptors that look most like the DAF2 receptor are the receptors for the hormones insulin and another one called insulin-like growth factor or IGF-1. And insulin is very famous because people that lack it or lack the ability to respond to it correctly get diabetes. So that tells you right off the bat that you can't just change this hormone receptor any old way and live to be 100. You might die. Okay? Right? Mm-hmm. You might just get diabetes and die. And so it looks, so that's kind of a paradox, but it looks like what gives you a long lifespan are changes in the genes that in the receptor that lower the activity of the receptor or the hormone. You can do it that way too. A little bit, but not a huge amount. And what happens when you do that, so first let me back up just a second to explain this. When you eat a meal, the level of sugar in your blood rises, and it's the sugar or glucose that causes the pancreas to release insulin. And that triggers a whole series of events. It allows your tissues to take up the nutrients into them, and it allows them to grow and to store food, and it sort of lets them live a kind of well-fed life. But when you lower food levels, you lower insulin levels, and so you lower the level of signaling through this insulin pathway, so less signal gets into the tissues. And what that seems to do is to shift the animal, shift the whole physiology of the animal to a state that's more concerned with just maintenance rather than growth. So you switch on a lot of genes in the genome that protect the cells, that protect their antioxidant genes. They strengthen the immune system. They change the way metabolism takes place. They do a number of different things. They help proteins fold correctly and keep them folded. So basically So first I have to back up. So when you lower the level of insulin or IGF-1 or the receptors for these genes, when you lower the level of, insulin or IGF-1 or their receptors, the first thing that happens is that the DAF16 protein, also called FOXO, it has two names, is called FOXO in higher organisms, and DAF16 in C. elegans. So it's a FOXO protein, and that protein becomes more active. Now that protein goes into the nucleus where the DNA is, and it binds to individual genes and switches them on or off. So when you lower the level of insulin or IGF-1 or the response to it, you activate DAF16 FOXO. It goes into the nucleus, sits down on the DNA in front of particular genes that can protect the cells, and switches them on. So there's maybe there's between 100 and 500 or so genes that get switched on or off in the DNA in response to changes in the activity of the insulin hormone or its receptor, or the IGF-1 hormone and its receptor. And it's the activation of all these different genes that leads to lifespan extension. You can think of it like an orchestra, where you have the flutes and the violins and the violas and the cellos, which would be like the antioxidant genes, the folding protein folding genes, the immunity genes, the metabolic genes, all doing something different, but doing them at the same time so that you can really protect the cells kind of from the ravages of time, if you will, so that the animal can stay young for a longer time.
Wow.
Okay? So that's how it works. It makes sense. And so these changes in the DAF16 FOXO in humans seem to be associated with the ability to live longer and to stay disease-free for a longer time. So it's really amazing.
I'd like to take a minute to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. Considering his recent passing, I think it'd be great to recommend a book by Michael Crichton. And that book is entitled Prey, P-R-E-Y. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play an audio sample. Here it is.
As a concept, nanotechnology dates back to a 1959 speech by Richard Feynman called There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom. 40 years later, the field is still very much in its infancy despite relentless media hype. Yet practical advances are now being made and funding has increased dramatically. Major corporations such as IBM, Fujitsu, and Intel are pouring money into research. The U.S. government has spent $1 billion on nanotechnology in the last 2 years. Meanwhile, nanotechniques are already being used to make sunscreens, stain-resistant fabrics, and composite materials in cars. Soon they will be used to make computers and storage devices of extremely small size. And some of the long-anticipated miracle products have started to appear as well. In 2002, one company was manufacturing self-cleaning window glass. Another made a nanocrystal wound dressing with antibiotic and anti-inflammatory properties. At the moment, nanotechnology is primarily a materials technology, but its potential goes far beyond that. For decades, there has been speculation about self-reproducing machines. In 1980, a NASA paper discussed several methods by which such machines could be made. 10 years ago, two knowledgeable scientists took the matter seriously, and I quote them, "Within 50 to 100 years, a new class of organisms is likely to emerge. These organisms will be artificial in the sense that they will originally be designed by humans. However, they will reproduce and will evolve into something other than their original form. They will be alive under any reasonable definition of the word. The pace of evolutionary change will be extremely rapid. The impact on humanity and the biosphere could be enormous, larger than the Industrial Revolution, nuclear weapons, or environmental pollution. We must take steps now to shape the emergence of artificial organisms. End of quote.
So as you may know from listening to this show and other shows on the TWiT network, Audible is always offering a free audiobook download for new subscribers. You simply subscribe to the service by going to audible.com/biotech, and they will give you a credit towards a free book. Now, if you don't like the service, you can always cancel, and you still get to keep the free book. They have over 50,000 titles now, so certainly worth giving it a try. Anyhow, thank you, Audible, and back to our interview.
Do the worms, when you... So you have knockouts that actually increase the lifespan twofold. Do you have mutants that are partial mutants that lead to even further increase in lifespan? And what do the worms look like? Are they, you know, there's living a short, happy life, and then there's living a long, lousy life with that.
Long, miserable life, yeah. Well, okay. So first of all, I have to tell you, if you knock out this receptor, the DAF2 gene, which encodes the receptor for insulin and IGF-1, so in worms, there's only one receptor for both hormones. IGF-1 is a hormone that's a little like, it's a bit like insulin, but it mainly promotes growth. Small dogs, actually, this is interesting. Small dogs live a lot longer than large dogs, as it turns out. And that's because they have less IGF-1. It's been shown they're small because they have less IGF-1, and they live longer because they have less IGF-1. So isn't that neat?
Yeah.
Now, it turns out if you start with a normal worm that has its normal size, or not a worm, let's start with a mouse because we know more about mice, and you start lowering IGF-1 levels or the level of signaling through this pathway, the first thing that happens is that the mouse lives long, but it has a normal size. And then it looks like is if you keep lowering the level, then it lives long and has a small size. So the size and the lifespan don't have to go together. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You don't. In other words, these animals, these long-lived animals, they're not always small.
Are there other genes as well that you were mentioning that in other labs they identified other pathways? Do these pathways, can they work in an additive fashion or?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a great question. Okay, first, I forgot to tell you, you mentioned about, do we have partial gene mutants that live? Anyway, if you
sure.
knock out, if you completely remove this receptor in any animal, the animal dies.
Okay? Oh, that's right.
It doesn't develop. So it's completely essential. So all the mutations that increase lifespan are partial loss of function mutations or mutations that just affect a certain tissue. You know,
mm-hmm.
those are the kind that can increase lifespan. Yes. Can you make an animal that lives even longer? Yes, you can. We did it several years ago. We discovered in our lab that the reproductive signals from the reproductive system affect lifespan. And if you change the reproductive system in certain ways, then the animals live long. And if you have the DAF2 mutant and you also fool around with the reproductive system, now the worms can live six times as long as normal. And again, and in both the DAF2 mutants and these six-fold mutants, the thing that makes them so amazing is that they stay young longer. That's the thing that boggles the mind, because you're sort of brought up thinking that, you know, there's death and taxes and there's just nothing you can do about it, you know?
That's right.
And so that's so amazing. You change one gene and an animal, it's not that they live long so much as that they stay young long. It's looking at these animals... Looking at a plate of animals, it's like you have two plates. On one plate, these are little auger dishes where we keep our worms. On one auger dish, we have lots of normal worms. And if you wait a couple of weeks and look at them, they're almost all dead or they're just barely hanging on. And you look at the mutants and they're moving around. They look young. So it's like magic. It really is. It's like, you know, you had a magic wand and they live, they're not old. And then, of course, the first thing you think is, well, hey, wait a minute, maybe I don't really have to be old either, even though I am. I didn't have to be. And I think that's probably true, that we probably didn't have to be old. It's our genes are set in a way that we are, but it didn't have to be that way. It just as it doesn't have to be that way for the worm.
So,
but it's this youthfulness that is so striking and so counterintuitive.
This would be interesting, of course, you know, to the pharmaceutical industry to push back age-related diseases, right? The three largest killers are cardiovascular disease, cancer, and stroke.
Yep.
And if you could delay mm-hmm. those on the onset of those, you're going to save millions of lives, billions.
Yeah, and actually, we already know that if you make changes that would be predicted to extend lifespan, you do in mice, for example, you do delay cancer, and you delay atherosclerosis, you delay heart disease in fruit flies, protein aggregation diseases, and lots of different kinds of animals are delayed. So it really looks like it makes sense in a way. The animals aren't old, so they're not susceptible to the age-related diseases until later when they are old. That's you know, here's a way I like to put it. Suppose you are a guy, maybe 30 years old, or maybe let's say 45 years old, and you are single and you'd like to get married. Meet someone. So you start dating and you date someone, you find a lovely woman that you like a lot, and you go out and you're, you know, having dinner and you think she's just great. And you ask her at one point, well, how old are you? And she says, I'm 90. That's what we're talking about. And that's the thing that's so hard to, that's what one worm would say to another. It would say, how old are you? I'm 90. You know, if that's, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
if
people don't get,
they always think
that the person looks 90, but they're healthy, but it's not that way. They look like this lovely, not that 90-year-old people aren't lovely. They are, but they look different than people that are 40, you know? So there you go.
Our guest 2 shows ago was 90, or her name, Brenda Milner. She was 90.
Wow.
Yeah. And she was great. She was absolutely fantastic. Sharp.
That's great.
It was fun. This is very dramatic science, right? This is not your traditional, biology trying to study, biochemical pathway or signaling pathway to making membranes, or how does the cell control its biological clock.
So let me just tell you now, so far, you get these absolutely phenomenal changes in C. elegans. Actually, somebody recently has extended the lifespan of worms by a factor of 10. And again, they seem to stay young longer, which is just amazing. And nothing like that has happened in mice, for example. The changes that you get in mice now tend to be about 40% at the most, from, say, 15 to 20 to 40%. There are some mice that live maybe 50% longer, but you're not getting 3 or 4-fold changes. But at the same time, you know, there haven't really been that many long-lived mutants in mice at all. And it makes sense that most of them wouldn't live that long, and just some would live really long. So maybe we haven't worked enough. You know, remember, evolution did it. I mean, evolution could go from a worm's lifespan of 2 weeks to a human lifespan of 70, 80 years, which is thousands of folds longer. So the potential, I mean, evolution did it already.
That's right.
It has happened, and as I say, multiple times. But anyway, so far, you know, we do see this correlation between having certain versions of the DAF16 FOXO gene and an increased lifespan in people. But the increase isn't a doubling. It is more frequent in people who live. These forms of the gene are more frequent in people who live longer, suggesting that if, you know, a biotech company were to go in and make a drug that could, whatever's changing in the protein to let these people live a little longer, maybe if you sort of go further along that route, maybe you could allow them to live a lot longer.
What stage is the current pharmacological development for these genes in terms of proving that they're an actual drug target, that you can actually modulate their activity in vivo?
Okay.
I mean, animal models are knockouts or mutants that are genetic based, but can this be done with pharmacology?
Yes, I think, yes, it should be possible. Now, all right. So there's one protein which you know about called, or family of proteins called the sirtuins. Mm-hmm. And those proteins, when overexpressed, at least in worms and in yeast, possibly flies as well, can extend lifespan. It hasn't been done in mice. We don't know yet for mice. But the proteins have also been implicated in many different age-related diseases. And there are companies, there's a company, Sirtris, which has been looking for drugs that activate the sirtuins, hoping to be used to combat age-related metabolic disease or whatever other potential kind of diseases. Insertris has drugs that are apparently behaving well in clinical trials. I don't know if the clinical trial data are known, but at least in animal trials, they were behaving nicely. And Insertris was purchased recently by GlaxoSmithKline.
$700 million?
Yeah, that's right. So that's, and Insertris, by the way, this in at least in C. elegans, the way that the sirtuins extend lifespan is by activating DAF16-FOXO, this protein I've been talking about. Mm-hmm. So these are not different worlds here. This is a very interconnected kind of system.
I'll refer the guests back to episode 2, which was a couple of years ago with Leonard Garanti. They can also get a little bit of background on the sirtuins.
I mean, another way you can look at it is that at least in worms, you can get worms to live long by lowering the level of insulin IGF-1 signaling, which activates DAF16, or you can get them to live long by activating the sirtuins, which also activates DAF16. So there's different, and in fact, there's four or five other things you can do in worms that also increase lifespan by activating DAF16. So DAF16 seems to be a very central player, and I think that's probably why you're seeing this effect on human longevity, these polymorphisms that affect humans, because it seems to be such a central protein.
This is right.
But yeah, so basically, so here's, it's really interesting. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's okay.
Go ahead.
You go.
Okay. So I think obviously you can't make a drug in a pharmaceutical company for aging, at least not right now, but you can certainly make drugs for diseases of aging. And since all these longevity pathways also affect diseases, what you can do is you can target a known longevity pathway and look for efficacy in combating a certain disease, cancer, diabetes, whatever. I founded a company with Lenny Garanti called Elixir, and our company has been developing drugs for another target called the ghrelin receptor. So ghrelin is a hormone that affects appetite and also metabolism, and it's a component of this large insulin IGF-1 regulatory network. And we've developed compounds that allow mice that are fed a high-fat diet to be much healthier than they would normally be. So, and so again, what we did is we thought, okay, look, here's a pathway, a general pathway that we know affects aging, but we think it also has links to metabolic disease. And so let's go after that. So that's what we've done at Elixir.
You said you can't develop a drug in a pharmaceutical setting to combat error two for
well, you can do it, but you have to do it, but you can't, you have to get it approved for a disease, but that's okay.
Why is that? Is that?
Oh, it's just because there's a couple of reasons. We don't have really good markers for aging. We don't have good biochemical markers that would say that if you could do a clinical trial in a year, for example, and if there was something you could measure, like some level of some protein that would tell you, okay, this person's rate of aging has slowed down, that would be great. But there isn't anything like that. We call that a biomarker. There's nothing like that right now.
Wow.
Whereas there are proteins that get glycosylated or damaged in diabetics, and you can look at those proteins and, you know, biochemically, and you can say yes in a year or even less. You can say yes. If they take this drug, this protein is less damaged, so the drug is working. So just from a practical point of view, the expense and the time constraints, it's much easier to assay something having to do with the disease than the process of aging, at least now, because we don't know how to measure aging over short time periods.
Right. You could do the 40-year clinical trial, but I suppose that doesn't make sense. I thought it was because maybe some ethical issue of trying to
– I don't think
those
so.
Those who could afford to maybe could gain the benefit of living longer.
Yeah, I mean you can – anyway, that's the way it's working right now. Plus, the other thing is the approval process by the FDA is for diseases right now. There's no approval process for an anti-aging drug. It just doesn't exist, which doesn't mean it couldn't exist in the future, but there's just not a regulatory framework there. But that's fine because, like I said, these aging pathways are inextricably linked to diseases. All these age-related diseases seem to be delayed, a whole variety, in long-lived mutants. So why not just go after diseases? And maybe as a sort of nice side effect, you'll live longer too. And not only because you don't die from the disease, but because you're just generally younger.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you with this one framework, you're going to be tackling the three major pathologies that affect humankind.
That's right. I mean, think of a tree with all these, you know, there's a trunk and then there are the limbs and then there are the little twigs, you know, and at the end of each twig, you could have an age-related disease. So you could make a drug that goes after a twig, this twig or that twig, or you could make a drug that goes for the trunk of the tree, and that would be aging. So if you delay, aging is the biggest risk factor for a whole variety of diseases, bigger than smoking for cancer. Age is a bigger risk factor for cancer than smoking is. So it's huge. And it's not just cancer. It's many, many, many different diseases. So yeah, if you could go after that risk factor, you could benefit lots of diseases. And that's why it is becoming of interest to pharmaceutical companies. When Lenny and I were starting our company, we went around and talked to pharmaceutical companies, thinking ahead that we might eventually want to partner our programs with them. And we talked to various ones, and they all said, well, we can't do that. We don't have an aging program. We have a program, you know.
They should, they will.
Well, they do. Novartis now has established a program in aging. So I see this as a watershed event, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's a big major pharmaceutical company, and they've looked at this kind of research, and they've said, yes, we need, you know, we need an institute for aging research, and they have it now within their company. Or not really research, but development, yeah.
Before we get to the last segment of this interview, I'd like to thank GoToMeeting for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. Currently, they're offering a 30-day free trial of GoToMeeting. That means you get a free month of online meetings. It works both on your PC and your Mac, so it's cross-platform. You don't have to worry about it. One of the reasons I like having GoToMeeting as a sponsor is that it's a product that I can really endorse. It is a tremendous tool for the scientific community. Rather than sending out PowerPoint files, which may be large, out to your colleagues, or sharing a PDF document, you can actually work and crunch the numbers together and do your data analysis together. Everybody can make a contribution. They see your desktop, they can manipulate your desktop, and you can really get everybody's input on that data. So it certainly saves you on traveling. It's easy, takes 2 minutes to set up, it's secure. There's a very low rate. Even scientists can afford it. And so right now, they're offering that 1 month of free service, unlimited meetings. So go visit gotomeeting.com/biotech. Now, back to the interview.
What are the ethical issues, I suppose, in terms of...
Oh, they're huge. They're huge, and they're complicated. So basically, right now, what we can hope for is a pill that would keep you young, maybe a few years longer, and would delay a lot of diseases. Or if you get the diseases, maybe that you wouldn't have such a hard time with them. Maybe you would be somewhat a little bit more resistant to them. That's what we're thinking right now. So, you know, people are already out there making drugs to cure diseases. They've been doing that for a long time, and there's no ethical issue. There's nobody saying, oh, it's unethical to cure cancer. No one says that, and it's not. It's good.
Right.
But the consequence is people don't die of cancer, so they stay alive and they're older. So we change the demographic distribution toward the elderly. We have more elderly people alive now needing care, actually, than we used to when they died of even infections. So we've changed the demographic distribution of ages in the world by doing, you know, by making drugs for diseases. So that has a consequence. Now, if you... and I think it's a good consequence. I mean, we have to figure out how the society is going to care for these people that are old, the baby boomers, for example. It's an issue. That's a big, important issue out there. But okay, so our drug, a drug that you would take that would delay aging, would be different, at least theoretically, in a way, in the sense that people would actually be getting old at a slower rate. So they would be productive for a longer time. So they may not have to retire at age 65 or 70. They may be able to work. They may want to work. They may feel young and look young at older ages. You see? So that's good. They'll remain productive for a longer period of time. Eventually they'll get old, but they won't spend a larger proportion of their lives in the nursing home than anybody else does. Probably about the same proportion, or maybe even less, a smaller fraction of their life. So that's all good. But there's all sorts of implications for that. If you know, first of all, well, we'll have more people in the world, right, if they're not dying. So the birth rate probably has to come down overall in the whole world, or we'll just fill up the world with, I mean, the world can't support an infinite number of people. So it has to come down, and it would have to come down more if there are more people living longer. Okay,
as countries gain in economic status, I suppose, birth rates tend to drop anyway.
Yeah, and there are a number of countries right now that have negative birth rates, you know, where the people aren't even replacing themselves already. So for those countries, you can see, well, gee, if everybody stayed young longer, that would be actually good. So there wouldn't be that aspect
human,
of the
society is reactive to that, I suppose. And we are living longer, so the countries that live the longest have the lowest birth rates. So I think it's not it's not mandatory. There's no social policy that needs to be in place. It tends to just happen, I suppose.
I think that's right. And you could imagine. So here's the thing. Now, this is where fantasy starts or speculation starts. But we tend to think of the world as always being the way it is now. But it doesn't have to be. For example, the Chinese have a policy of the one child policy. And that's one country, and that's their policy. And we don't have that policy. We used to have a policy in this country of eugenics, in a sense, where we aborted babies, or not aborted them, but I guess sterilized people who were mentally defective, which we all see as abhorrent, and I see that as abhorrent. And I'm not crazy about the one child policy, so I'm not advocating those. But what I'm saying is that what a society thinks will always have to be the way it is won't always necessarily have to be the way it is. So, for example, suppose everybody – so let's just fantasize here for a second. And suppose people live to be 200. And at age 100, they were sort of like 50-year-olds are today. They're still very, you know, very productive. Let's just suppose. Okay, so they're aging more slowly and living longer. Now, what would happen? Well, first thing that would happen, I think, is you wouldn't be given tenure at a university at age 35 anymore, right? If you're not going to retire until you're 107. So that you can see is going to change right away. Second thing is, what happens when you check into the nursing home? If you're taking this pill, are you going to be able to take the pill if you're in the nursing home already? Or will there be laws passed saying that, no, you can't take it anymore? Because when you're in the nursing home and someone else is supporting you, maybe you should just die at your normal rate, right? So you can imagine that kind of a law being passed. Here's another law you could imagine. You could imagine that the insurance companies would make you take the pill, that because if you took the pill, you'd be more resistant to disease. So you could imagine that you would have to just to get insurance, or you'd get a discount if you took the pill. You could imagine, here's another thing. If you, right now, people can, you know, run countries or companies or stay in universities and so forth, often until they pretty much die, stay on the Supreme Court, you know, as long as they want. If a person could really live to be 200, that would probably change. I sort of said that before with tenure, but that whole concept can be expanded to include lots of other things. So probably there would be more mandatory retirement from one job and accompanied by retraining programs, you know, or at least incentives to change, or maybe people would just want to change. But I think that would be a fundamental change in our society.
These aren't small changes to society. These are massive or very large changes to society.
They're humongous. But again, remember, we don't have that pill right now. And let's suppose I went into my lab tonight and I made the pill. And tomorrow I arrive with the pill, okay? And I give it out and people start taking it, right? Mm-hmm. They start taking it tomorrow. What does the world look like in 5 years? Well, it doesn't look very different from what it looks like now. People who are 55 right now, instead of looking 60, well, maybe they look, I don't know, 57 and a half. It's not sure. That different. And 5 whole years have gone by. And that's a pill that doubles your lifespan, which we're not going to make right now. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Right.
Probably what we're going to make in a lab is a pill that adds maybe 2 or 3 years to your healthy lifespan at the beginning. We might not. No one expected to change one gene and double the lifespan of a worm. So I cannot tell you that we can't do that with a person. Maybe we could. We could find a pill that will just, it could happen. But I still don't see it. I don't know. It seems unlikely, but it could. More likely, you will get these little incremental changes. So society is going to have a huge amount of time to react to this. Enormous. Lots of discussions. Lots of time.
I suppose, you know, until, for example, the risks of these new pharmacological products are assessed, the only people who are really going to want to take them are people where the benefit is absolutely clear. One, heart disease, diabetes.
Absolutely.
You know, so they're gonna be our guinea pigs, I suppose.
But, I know, they're kind of imperfect guinea pigs in a sense for aging because they already have a disease.
And their lifespan is already shortened prematurely. So they're going to be able to maybe live to a normal life.
Mm-hmm. But maybe people who have a genetic predisposition towards cancer would take it just naturally. Maybe they would take it. Mm-hmm. And even when they're not sick, you know, and maybe you would realize that these people people were taking estrogen, right? That's a nice big experiment done on the whole population. Women were taking estrogen, lots of them, thinking, of course, that any hormone that goes down you get old and the hormone goes down. So probably if it didn't go down, you'd be healthier, you know, but actually maybe we're healthier probably because it goes down, because people who were taking estrogen became susceptible to lots of different age-related diseases. And so these were healthy people, right? These mm-hmm. were healthy people that were taking it, and you got to see all these, you know, it wasn't an experiment, but had it been designed that way, it would have been a very interesting one. And it kind of is equivalent of an experiment. Kind of scary in a way. But the other thing is, we were able to figure that out probably before it did a huge amount of harm to the society, you know? So I think, you know, if there's an anti-cancer pill or anti-heart disease pill, people will probably take it. Like, they're already taking statins. And statins actually turn out to have benefits above and beyond the purpose for which they were first developed. So it'll be interesting. I don't know that statins are anti-aging drugs. I have no idea. But it'll be interesting to see people are starting to take them just as a preventative measure. So, you know, if that ever happens to an anti-aging drug, then you'll start to see, wow, you look at the incidence of various diseases and these people aren't getting them as much. So you'll get, even before you know of how old they are, you'll see that they're resistant to lots of diseases. And so more people will start taking the drugs, I think. That's how it will probably distribute itself through the world, just because people will be healthier.
I guess countries where the healthcare is universal, Canada, the European countries, I suppose that government would have a huge incentive to, of course, make it free for everybody, and then mm-hmm. there wouldn't be a selective process within the communities to take it. You might see some countries now experience far greater discrepancies in lifespans between, for example, Canada and the U.S., where the diet is the same, the lifestyle is the same, the you know, number of miles people walk per day is pretty much the same.
But this is where social policy comes in. Okay, let's suppose only the rich could take the pill, okay? So you have all these rich people that aren't getting any diseases, whereas poor people are. I mean, I'm not saying they won't get any diseases. I'm exaggerating mm-hmm. just to make my point here. Okay, but suppose there's this wonderful pill and the rich people are taking it and they're doing so well. What's going to happen? The poor people, they're not going to want that. People like Obama, he's going to say, well, look, if you elect me as president, I'm going to make this pill available for everybody. People are going to want it, and they're going to get it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's intrinsically almost impossible to make, which is very hard to believe. You know, almost anything, if you want it enough, you can figure out a way to make it pretty cheaply.
Sure.
So it's going to be available, and I think it's going to be available very fast, actually. If it really has an effect against a lot of diseases, of course it will be, because the society will make it.
Democracy.
They'll demand it. You'd have a revolution. I mean, think about it. So I'm not worried about that aspect of it.
I suppose that goes without saying. If it's really good for the community, all parties would embrace it on the political level. I mean, when there was an economic crisis, both McCain and Obama went to Washington and tried to have a positive effect. So they didn't, no one neglected the issue per se.
Now, the other side, though, is another one to think about. What if the pill has a side effect, right? You don't know that it won't. Or what if it doesn't actually act the same way in everybody? These, of course, are concerns with all pills that anybody takes. But, you know, if you take a pill every day of your life, or, you know, starting to take it, let's say, at age 30 or something, you really have to start worrying about side effects. So those are issues also that are going to be important. There may be people that won't take it just because I don't take resveratrol, for example. Resveratrol apparently has a lot of good health benefits and can extend the lifespan of a lot of animals. But I don't take it because I just don't, I don't know. I'm just scared, really. I'd rather wait until
there's
been a lot of trials before I subject my body to that. I do take aspirin every day, little aspirin. Yep. So maybe I am. But, you know, I don't.
But that's been
vetted.
That drug is as safe as a drug can get.
I think it is. So I take it because it has benefits.
When the populations that need to push back age-related diseases, if you have diabetes and you want to push it back 15 years or 20 years, and you know that that can happen, and the risk of perhaps a non-desired side effect is you evaluate that. I guess you make that decision yourself, and then you
You do. And probably you know actually also the other thing is people will give it to their pets. Of course, and they'll see their pets are, you know, in great shape and living longer and, you know, running around. So I think there's that too, that kind of thing will happen. That could actually be a big factor in spreading the use of a drug like this. But you never know. I mean, you have to worry. But even then, you know, nowadays we've become so good, I think, at looking for little things that go wrong that are harbingers of a disease, you know, a change in cholesterol levels or something. You know, we may even be able to pick up side effects. And that's the other thing. Science is going to be marching on in parallel to the development of these anti-aging drugs. And scientists are going to find, hold on just a second. Scientists are going to find ways of, for example, learning which people have different susceptibilities to different kinds of drugs, which people might be at risk for certain side effects by examining the effects of differences in the genomes between different people. That's happening. So that's a kind of science that can be brought to bear on this as well.
Personalized medicine, yeah. Proteomics and
I think
there's a grant application out there that's going around. I think they're asking for about $1 billion to do the human proteome. I think that'll push human medicine or personalized medicine.
It's
ahead.
Wonderful.
These are really exciting times.
They are. Now, don't hold your breath for this aging pill, though. You know.
All right, my kids though, they might be able to. To benefit, though we don't have any major diseases in our family that other than.
Oh,
normal.
That's good.
Yeah.
Listen, I have to go now because I have an appointment at 4. Is that okay? Is that
yes,
enough?
I think we did. We've got everything. Just for as a closing, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Okay, you're welcome, and I enjoyed it too.
I'd really like to thank Dr. Cynthia Kenyon for her time today and the great discussion. She is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also the director of the Larry Hillblom Center for the Biology of Aging. I'd also like to thank Phil Pelche and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. And if you'd like the transcripts to today's episode, they've been kindly provided by the folks at Pods in Print. You can visit them at podsinprint.com. If you'd like to get some transcripts done, as you can tell, they can cover very specialized topics, and they do it really well. So they'll find a specialist to tackle the subject that you need transcripts for. Lastly, I'd like to thank Leah Laporte and Dane Golden for co-producing this podcast. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier. Oh, by the way, before we go, I have permission from the folks at Small Pictures Productions to play the audio from a John Cleese podcast, and it's John Cleese's take on human genetics. Here's the audio.
Hello. We scientists have now located a gene which we scientists believe gives people the need to believe in God. In other words, this God gene releases chemicals into our body which create the impression that there is meaning in the universe. And this God gene is just here between the gene which we scientists now know makes us eat coconut ice cream after a fish dinner and this gene here which causes people with weak egos to grasp around desperately for simple explanations. Now, The discovery of this God gene is a big step forward in our quest to show that every bit of human behavior can be explained away mechanically, because we've now also located the gene which makes some people believe that every piece of human behavior can be explained away mechanically. And it's here, right next to the gene that makes you go to see Nicolas Cage movies, so that's another puzzle solved, and right under this gene, which can cause you to forget that since the 1920s, quantum physics has destroyed forever the idea that everything can be explained mechanically. Now, the gene which causes us to forget this obvious fact is very dominant in some people, especially me. And we scientists now know that it's closely linked to this gene here, which gives you such a weak sense of self that you hang on to anything that makes you feel more secure emotionally, whether it's fundamentalist religion or a reductionist view of the universe, which is right over this gene here that makes you want to punch people in the head when they take the scientific process and subject it to their pathological literal-mindedness. Thank you. I needed that. And by the way, we now know that there is a gene that causes you to say, "Thank you, I needed that," just there, when you are punched in the head.